1907.
You're listening to Country Squire Radio.
Welcome to Country Squire Radio. I'm Bo.
And I'm John David.
Jenny!
Hey, Bo. How you doing, Bo?
I'm doing really well. Like, really, really well. How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah, doing great.
I'm so glad, man, because, like this is the thing.
Like, you sound like someone that just drank some gin and tonic.
Well, I there was no tonic involved, I assure you.
Oh, okay. That helps. We understand that.
Yeah. No, listen, man, we've got a fun episode we're going to be diving into this week. But I want to take, like, a brief moment, really quick, because I feel like it needs to be, like, acknowledged. So this year, you and I, we've been traveling around this great country, at least, you know, one specific quadrant of this great country. And, you know, we entered into this year with kind of, like, grand vision of, like, how we wanted to do this and kind of this next era and this next kind of phase of Country Squire Radio and everything.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, it's we had high hopes. As we kind of like charged forward into this era, right? And part of that was we wanted to get together, be in the same room, get that energy of, like, classic Country Squire Radio.
Yeah.
And, like, check, done. Like, honestly, like, I feel, and I think the listeners have been able to feel this too.
That part's been solid.
Yeah. And I mean, like, the energy is there, the charisma is there. You and I, we have the ability to kind of, like, do that, like, nonverbal communication sometimes.
Right.
That, like, that kind of helps. That also kind of lets we're like, all right, hang on. Oh, no, we don't want to disrupt standards and practices. Let's gear it back in. It's like that nice, like, flow that kind of goes into it, and just, like, the natural energy that comes in. So that's been really good. We also wanted the opportunity to kind of step away from life and kind of get a chance to spend some time with one another, just in general, because, like, you know, we're friends and, like, we haven't seen each other.
I know,
and,
right? Yeah.
You know, you get to a certain age.
It becomes this regular reunion kind of deal.
Yeah. And you do get to kind of, like, a stage in life where it's like the friends you've got are the friends you got.
That's
you,
true.
You want to, like, you know, those are, you know.
Don't lose them.
One is silver, one is gold, or whatever the saying is, right? And, like, we want to make sure, I don't know what to say.
Like, what are you talking about?
No, the point is that it's like, we want to make sure that we're treasuring that relationship by, you know, like fueling it by spending some time together that this year has afforded us. I mean, we're midway through the year, but I know this episode's going to come out later in the year and that sort of thing. I'm trying to calculate fourth dimensionally, as Doc Brown would say, but regardless, like, that's been really good, right? Like, so check mark there. Here's the thing, man. We've wanted so bad to, like, go so many places. And the fact of the matter is that, dude, you've got a young family. You've got, like, we both have young families, but you got a young family. You got like an infant family right now.
Yeah, it's I mean, frankly, just been harder to accomplish than we thought it would be.
Well, and it's tough. And so, like, I just want to, like, acknowledge that, like, you know, with these podcasts that we've been working on, you know, we bring a lot of ourselves into them. We bring a lot of knowledge. We bring a lot of, like, charisma. We bring, you know, kind of our history, relationship with each other and with the audience into it. And it's heavy lifting. But, man, I just want to acknowledge that you've been doing some heavy, heavy lifting, like, especially this particular retreat in particular.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate you, brother. And,
yeah.
Like, I know that you want to keep some things close to the chest, and I appreciate that. But I just need the listeners to know that John David has been doing the work for y'all right now. And y'all need to, you know, show him some love. This will probably be weeks in the future.
Yeah, no, right.
You know, but I just, but it'll still count. So, well, show John David some love.
Well, that's kind of Bo. Yeah. I mean, we obviously have to, you know, sacrifice to, you know, do what we do and do what we love and do what we're obligated to do. And so here we are, and we're thankful, man, to God for all the blessings that he's given us. And we just keep on moving.
Yeah, man.
Yep.
Speaking of moving, we will be moving into outside of this quadrant, which we have, I think it's safe to say,
right,
Country Squire Radio has dominated this quadrant of the United States.
We done woe it out.
Yeah. This the SEC, who'd have thunk it? We stuck in that area. Well, actually, Texas isn't in the SEC, is it?
It is now.
Oh, is it now?
Yeah, it is. Texas A&M has been in the SEC for, I don't know, several years, yeah.
Okay.
And then Texas, the UT, Austin, is going to be joining the SEC in a few years.
Well, there you go. So, all right, so fair enough. So we've dominated the SEC.
Yeah, done. Conquered.
We conquered it. It's time to step out a little bit further, and I think you know where this is going. We're going to the Las Vegas Vibe Show.
Ow!
Viva Las Vegas October, man. It's going to be a lot of fun. We want people to go to the website.
VegasPipeShow.com. Go there. Be sure to go ahead and buy your ticket now.
Yes.
Go ahead and do that now. October 21st through 23rd. Get your plane tickets. Buy your ticket to the show. And man, the purchase covers the entrance fee. It comes with a free entry to win a few door prizes. And man, it's going to be a great time. Obviously, like any good pipe show, you'll have the opportunity to purchase awesome stuff and interact with some of the world's most famous pipe makers and tobacconists and things of that nature. But this is put on by our good friend, Brian Levine of Pipes Magazine Radio fame. And Brian, you know, he's really plugged into the industry. He has a good finger on the pulse of what is, you know, going to be exciting for pipe enthusiasts. And so he's really put a lot of energy into the social media and the new media aspect of this. So you're going to have YouTubers featured and podcasters and all the creative minds that make the current pipe community so special. It's going to be something to really, really look forward to. So we're looking forward to seeing you, and we can't wait to. Oh man, be sure to get your tickets, sign up, and we'll see you there.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be awesome. You know, the great thing about Las Vegas is it is a part of classic Americana. You know, you no matter
it is.
Yeah.
It really is.
You can't argue that. Like whatever you try to project onto it, whatever your kind of idea of Vegas is, you have to acknowledge that it is a critical part of classic Americana. When people think of America, they've got like these little like pockets, because we're such a diverse nation, man.
Yeah.
Like it's such a massive country with so many like diverse landscapes and areas and cultures and and cities. And you've got these kind of hallmark cities that stand out as those kind of pinnacle, iconic spaces.
Yeah.
And it's the way in which we are represented to the world is through these different cities.
Good or bad.
Good or bad.
Yeah.
And how we kind of export, you know, that imagery and what we choose to own, what we don't choose to own, what we don't have any choice on, because it's just we have to own it because it is who we are. America is an amazing country, is it not?
It is.
It really is. And part of what we are known for around the world, like, you know, you think about what comes from America. And while this has been, there's been a lot of competition in this area, but when you think historically, America, one of its best exports has been movies.
Yeah.
Movies.
And one of its most influential, probably.
I mean, would think so.
Culturally, I mean, you think about, yeah.
Power of film is hard to understate.
Yeah.
It, as said on an audio podcast, the power of the visual. The power of the visual. But, you know, it's interesting. I've been very much on like a movie, not even like movie kick, but like classic Hollywood.
Yeah.
There is a series right now on Paramount Plus called The Offer. Have you heard of this at all?
No.
Okay. So Paramount, you know, all of these different companies have their streaming service. You got Disney Plus, you got the, you know, Netflix. Everybody's got their own Netflix now and whatever Plus and whatever it is. Paramount has their Paramount Plus. I got onto it because they were doing a Halo series, and I loved the video game back in the day. I wanted to see the show. Show was, you know, it was all right. But the funny thing is, you know, Paramount Plus also has all of like the Star Trek stuff.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. And I started watching that new Picard series, and I enjoyed the first season a lot. The second season was, you know, it is what it was. But the first season I enjoyed very much. And I started watching the new, I think it's called Strange New Worlds, and it's like the Enterprise kind of Captain Kirk era,
okay,
or like early era in that kind of vein. And it's been like classic adventure of the week type of just,
right,
you know, food for thought, but also kind of like just candy for your brain at the same time. You know, like, and it's been good. I've enjoyed it. But while I've been going for those shows, I kept on getting this promotion for The Offer. And The Offer tells the story of the creation of The Godfather. And it's like the background, like the producer that was working behind the scenes and the studios and everything else. And ever since, it's a great show, by the way. I highly recommend that series, especially if you like The Godfather, which I love The Godfather. Like, I highly recommend it. But as I was watching that series and like, you know, all these like mobsters and all these like movie producers and all these different people that were like involved in it and just kind of the back end of like Hollywood, you know, it got me in this mindset of like, you know, I bet there were a lot of pipes in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, like behind the scenes, you think about like classic Americana earlier even than that, because I think that was like 70s era. Like you had to have like a lot of meeting rooms that, you know, were packed with pipe smoke.
Sure.
And I was like, you know what? The next Half Bowl Histories that we do, I want to find a pipe smoker in the movie business that was like making movies. And it didn't take long.
I was about to say, they probably had several options.
Tons of folks. But what I found was an individual that was not just a pipe smoker and not just a movie maker. In fact, like his work in the movie industry was completely like, it's innovative. He was a champion. But beyond that, the dude was just a freaking like superhero, like an action hero, like of the movie variety before he even touched the motion picture.
That's crazy.
And I'm going to be talking to y'all today about Mirian C. Cooper. Now, here's what I love about, you know, our approach with Half Bowl Histories, right? Like before, with like histories, like a hero's the bowl, like, you know, that hero was always in the name. And so you always had to kind of like, all right, well, there needs to be something heroic about them and everything.
Yeah,
else.
Sure.
And, you know, I think
here's Satan. He smoked a pipe. Here's the bowl. Yeah.
No, Satan's a cigar smoker. Satan's a cigar
right.
smoker.
Right.
Let's be real.
Right.
But no. Satan does not smoke a pipe. Mirian C. Cooper did. My point, though, is that people are people. You know, like we're messed up individuals. You and I know this very, very well. Like there's no perfect human other than the one that was. But other than that, like there is no, like all of us have our flaws. And so like trying to kind of hold that hero standard.
Right.
That being said, with the Half Bowl Histories, we can look at just super interesting people with something of like just the lens of like, how interesting, you know what I mean? As opposed to like, let's talk about how heroic that was. That being said, this dude has got some history, some pretty epic history in his past. Mirian C. Cooper, he was born in Jacksonville, Florida on October 24, 1893. Now, 1893, like way back,
way
right?
Back.
Like we're casting our mind back here. He was, as a kid, he loved adventure like magazines and like travel magazines, but those, you know, this classic like, British, as the British boys have gone across to the world, they see the, you know, the tribes of Africa are here. And
exactly.
Now set up, they've got those, you remember those like caps they used to wear?
Yeah.
And like the big, like those pants, like the pants that like jacked up to their knees.
Yeah, with the plumes on the side of
right.
them and stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
This was the era where people, I mean, we still hadn't gone to Antarctica yet. Like we still haven't, as a human race, visited by this time the South Pole.
Right.
Like,
there's all of these areas of the world that are kind of in the like
still uncharted.
They were uncharted. And then you also had kind of the Western world kind of like seeping into all of these different areas.
Right.
Trying to, and like coming back with all these fantastic adventure stories and everything of like, you know, again, totally messed up views and everything that was
right,
like all
of course,
packed into
yeah.
it. But like that captured the imagination of this young boy of Mirian C. Cooper back in, you know, the 1890s. And so he was obsessed with kind of this concept of like adventure and travel and that Indiana Jones type of mindset. You know what I mean? Like before Indiana Jones was Indiana Jones. He would grow up. He graduated from Lawrenceville School in New Jersey in 1911, and he went off to join the Navy. Now, here's the thing. Mirian C. Cooper, he goes off, he joins the Navy. He's all about, you know, armed service. He's very much like a patriot kind of, you know, he's brought up in America. He's a very pro-America. The problem is that he is also very pro his own mind.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, I have not joined the armed forces. You know, you have not either. We've got several listeners who do. And from what I understand from friends who have served, a large part of what you do as you kind of go through that process is you kind of have to take yourself back and kind of like identify with the group as a whole. Like that's an important part of there's a term for that and I forget what it is, but you kind of like become part of your unit, right? Mm-hmm. Like it becomes your family and you have to kind of set, you know, whatever kind of identified you as an individual aside so that you can operate as a unit, right?
Yeah.
He was kind of bad at that. Like, and the worst part is that it came out not just in a, like, I'm an individual, but like, I'm an individual who thinks that like naval supremacy is BS. Like,
wow.
Specifically, I think that the Air Force could like basically come over here and just like dominate us. And so everybody like is like, he would argue constantly for the concept of aerial supremacy over the Navy in particular.
Right.
Like his own tribe, right? Like,
right.
So
right.
he was constantly like creating this rebel rousing type. He was this rebel rouser that existed in the Navy. And everybody hated him. They hated working with him and everything because he was like, I mean, like, you know, we could fly up here. You know, they just like kill us. We're just out here in boats. We're just sitting targets. You realize we're all sitting targets, guys, right? Like, you know, like you all realize this, right? So he doesn't last very long in the Navy because, again, he's constantly causing problems. And all he does is he talks about how much better it would be to fly. It's basically, it's kind of catty, honestly, for the armed forces, if you think about it. Like, you know, in the kind of like 19 teens, all things considered. But hey, you know, it is what it is. That's where he was.
That's interesting.
He left the Navy. He became a journalist in 1916. And at that same time, he also joined the National Guard. Now, kicked out of the Navy, joins the National Guard. Same basic concept here. He wants to fly. He doesn't like ships. He doesn't like you know, any kind of like naval or like the National Guard as it relates to anything on the ground or the sea. He longs to be in the air.
Wants to be in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it casts my mind back to Jacques Cousteau and how it was like the exact opposite for him, right? Like, he wanted to fly, but then he found his love of sea. And so we have this dude here who is constantly going out to sea, but wants to be in the air.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually does fairly well in his service for the National Guard. They're going to actually make him a lieutenant. But he finally turns that down. He's like, you know what? How about I just go learn how to fly? You know, like what?
Yeah.
He's like, you know, y'all hate me. All I do is talk about how much I wish I was like not here.
So get rid of me and put me in the air.
Exactly.
Give me what I want.
He goes to the aeronautics school in Atlanta. He graduates top of his class. And that's exactly what he does. Now, this happens to coincide with a tiny world event known as World War I.
Oh, that.
He joins up with the 201st Squadron and he goes off to France. And everybody's like, it's Cooper. Like, and he's like, guys, y'all, I wanted to be with y'all this whole time. I didn't even care about the Navy. Like, I wanted to be with y'all. I'm like, Cooper, you know, they're all, and they're like, oh yeah. And everybody, like, everybody's putting their hands in. It's like, come on boys, it's World War I. And Cooper's like, you mean there's going to be another one? Like he's geared up, man. He's giddy. Here's the thing. He goes on some pretty epic adventures during World War I. And during this time, a pretty insane experience happens. And when I say insane, you know, I'm using these kind of grand terms like insane, epic, you know, adventure. Right. These are all like high-end things. Well, let's be real. This is war, right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Filled with like traumatic experiences and everything that comes along with it. He's a pilot. He's quite good. This incident occurs. He's across enemy lines. All right. I'm going to kind of paint you this picture. World War I. Bomber plane, gun plane. He's the flyer. You know, they had the flyer and they had the gunman, right? So he's behind the wheel. He's the one flying. He's got his gunman. They're over enemy territories. They're dropping bombs. They get attacked. Okay. So, you know, the enemy's coming in. They're shooting at him. His plane gets hit. In fact, the engine gets hit. And not just that, his gunman gets shot in the neck.
Oh, wow.
Right. So at this moment, Cooper is flying a plane that is actively on fire as the fire and the smoke is coming in at him right at his face. He can't see a thing. He's like breathing in smoke. He turns around. He sees that his gunman is just gushing blood. Okay. And so this is before parachutes.
So tragic.
This is before parachutes, by the way. And so it's, you know, the plane's kind of starting to go down and he knows that, like, you know, this thing's going to crash. He's going to die.
Right.
You know, his buddy's out here. He's dead. So he climbs out the side of the plane and he's going to try to jump. Right. So it's like, as it comes down, it's like, okay, you jump out of the plane before it crashes over there.
Kind of,
you do a rolling
deal.
Exactly.
And hopefully it's soft enough. You don't break enough bones to die.
Exactly. Yeah. This is his mindset. So he's getting on the plane and he's getting ready to do this. He looks over, he sees his gunman who's bleeding out the neck and his eyes are fluttering. His gunman is still alive.
Oh, wow.
So Cooper gets back in the plane. Okay. Now, again, the fire's going on and everything else. He goes for the wheel, but his hands have been so burned by the fire that's been going on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's enduring this like intense like heat and pain, like climbing over the edge of this like metal plane. He can't use the steering wheel because his hands are so burned. He tries to grab hold of the wheel. His hands are extremely, very badly bent. You know, like he can't hold it. He uses his knees and his elbows, okay, like to like pilot the plane. So
wow,
we've all probably been there at some point where, and you shouldn't, but maybe you're holding your pipe and maybe you're holding your coffee and you're trying to drive the car.
Yeah,
and
you're in your car, so you're kind of, you know, jimmying it with your kneecap.
Exactly.
And, you know, stuff like that.
Which you shouldn't do. He had no choice in this situation.
Wow.
So his hands are burnt. So he gets back on there. This is crazy. He brings the plane back up in the air. And he does a 200-foot spiral dive to put out the flames so that so it's no longer on fire.
Wow.
Right? And it works. The flames go out, the smoke stops and everything, and then he's able to pull back up and very clumsily crash land the plane and not die.
With his knees and elbow.
With his knees and elbow and his gunman clinging onto life behind him.
Wow.
They both survive this whole experience. they would refer to it as their second birth.
Yeah, seriously.
Because they just kind of experienced this death and they go out. Now, when
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, this is all, like I mentioned before at the top of the story, he was behind enemy lines at the time, right? When this was all occurring. So when he crash lands behind enemy lines. And so he gets captured by the Germans and he's taken to a prison camp. And they say what you will about the Germans, but even when they're the enemies, they're still pretty good at medicine. So they were able to patch him up.
Yeah.
You know, they were able to patch him up pretty good. And so he spent the rest of the war at that point behind enemy lines in a prison camp. And while he was there, he met a lot of Russians and he was hearing about like the Bolsheviks back home.
Yeah.
And, you know, hearing kind of some of the horror stories, it made him like a fervent anti-communist. He was in that setting, that's kind of where kind of this very kind of aggressive anti-communism mindset was kind of born, hearing from these Russians back home and dealing with the Bolsheviks and everything. So he becomes kind of motivated both by these stories that he's hearing, but also by this sense of not completion.
Hmm.
And I think this was true for a lot of folks in World War I and just in war in general, is you go off, and I can't speak for actual warriors, of which I am not one, but I do think that from what I've heard, there seems to be this case where you go off to war inspired by whatever the call is. Maybe it's a patriotism, maybe it's a desire to take action because you see injustice, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And you go, but then you're part of the fight. And then the conclusion sometimes feels very lackluster.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of brought up on kind of adventure tales and stories with these kind of grand climactic conclusions.
Yeah, it should have been more resolved and all that.
Exactly. And so not only does he experience that, which I think a lot of soldiers do, he also has this added problem of having like lived out the last weeks of the war in a prison camp. So he wasn't even fighting during that time, right? And so he has this sense of like lack of conclusion as all of this is going on. And so he decides that afterwards he decides he wants to be of service. He goes over to Poland to help out with some of the relief efforts that are going on there. And he really establishes this like hardcore connection with the Polish people. So much so that he actually establishes, and I'm about to butcher this, the Kosciuszko Squadron. Kosciuszko Squadron, I think.
Oh, wow.
Does that sound right?
It does. That's interesting. This is very much an aside.
Yeah, yeah, by all means.
So Kosciuszko, if I'm remembering right, General Kosciuszko was a Polish person that came to help the Americans in the American War of Independence against Great Britain.
There you go.
Do you know there is a city in our great state of Mississippi named after this gentleman?
I did not know. But Kosciuszko does sound like a Mississippi city. I will
say
that.
But we call it Kosciuszko.
No.
And so Kosciuszko is pronounced Kosciuszko if you're a real, actual, intelligent person.
I had no clue of that.
But because we're Mississippians,
we call it Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko. And that's how I know that name.
Shut the front door. Oh, no. Are you serious?
That's exactly right. Matter of fact, they have, in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, they have a bronze statue of General Kosciuszko.
How about that?
Right there. That's the only reason I know that name.
What a wild connection, man. Well, yeah. So Cooper takes the, like, you know, he helps establish this fighter squadron of Americans who are fighting for the Polish. And he becomes a bomber during their war against the Bolsheviks. Again, he's a fantastic fighter pilot, obviously kind of a heroic warrior. He does get captured a lot.
Yeah.
So he's been captured before. And even during this time, he's actually captured by the Red Cavalry. And the Red Cavalry in particular was known for the ruthlessness of how they treat their captives. Now, as opposed to before, where after he was captured and, you know, they brought him back to health while he was in prison camp, he knows these guys, they ain't going to give him some like Tylenol. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's about to be a,
oh, man,
pretty rough situation. Here's the thing. Remember that whole situation with the plane going down and the fire and it burning his hands?
Yeah, sure.
So when the Red Cavalry actually captures him, they look at his hands and see how torn up they are. They assume he's a peasant, and thus they don't treat him as if he's like a prisoner of war.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
So like the scars that he got from that first crash, from that first capture, actually ended up saving him in many respects in the second one.
That's incredible.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
He goes out, he's able to escape from their prison, and he has one of the most highly traumatic moments of his life. And, you know, which is interesting. Given all that I've just said, a lot of highly traumatic moments that have all transpired. He has to, he comes across one of the Russian soldiers and in hand-to-hand combat has to kill him. Now, Cooper's actually killed people before. He's a fighter pilot and a bomber on top of that. So like he's done a lot of destruction. Hand-to-hand, like killing somebody with your bare hands is a whole different experience.
Yeah.
And
then while having these injuries, you know.
Well, exactly. But I think it was really more of the literally having to stab someone in the neck and watch them die like right there in front of you.
Wow.
Had this extremely just traumatic experience for him.
Yeah.
After the war, the Polish government actually reached out to Cooper. They wanted to thank him for his service, for what they've done. Because, you know, he's an American that's over here doing this for him. They want to give him land. They want to give him money. He doesn't take any of that. He doesn't want to profit at all from his experiences.
Wow. Yeah.
He was fervent. Like this man was very driven by his convictions. And one of those convictions was like anti-war profiteering.
Yeah.
You know, he was a warrior, but he would not profit from war.
Right.
You know what I mean? And,
that's interesting.
That comes into play later on in life as well. He goes back home. There's this kind of legend that he came back to New York City. He had like a few bucks and he had a jacket and he gave away his jacket and a few bucks so he could start completely clean and completely fresh and establish himself in kind of a new life post-war.
Wow.
In America. So 1922, he became an overseas documentarian so that he got a chance to finally indulge in his love and adventure, right? So you think, you know, that kid who had all of these dreams for seeing the world grows up and experience like goes off to war kind of excited, you know, not only am I going to war, I'm going to war as a pilot and I'm gonna like, yeah, like I'm gonna be like one of these good guys, you know, goes through like near death experiences, you know, has his body scarred, has his mind scarred, all of this stuff. And so now he just wants to go back and explore the world in like a non, you know, a kind of aggressive way, you know, like literally just with that love of adventure and kind of what's behind the next turn, what's over that peak, what's, you know, like conquering the earth itself as opposed to like trying like conquering other people.
Yeah, bloodlust or whatever.
Exactly. When it was never
not
about
bloodlust, but
that's fair. It's not about the bloodlust for him. It was he's very driven by his ideals, right? But this kind of is his chance to kind of, you know, explore the love of his youth from that standpoint.
Hmm.
His crew would go on these crazy expeditions and they would look for story and go out looking just to film it. So they wouldn't have a purpose. You couldn't do this today. Like, you know, like they didn't have like an agenda or a purpose or whatever. Like, no, we're going to go out. We're going to see what we can find. And when we find a story, that's when we're going to film it. And we're going to cut that together as the documentary. He would also push his crew to like crazy limits. And in fact, really redefined kind of what documenting kind of, especially wildlife was like. Because he would do these things where like, you know, like he would be like right up there and bring the camera right up to where a tiger was attacking and like let the tiger attack the camera.
Golly.
And this is not like a trained tiger. This is like out in the wilderness. This is a feral tiger, right?
Feral tiger.
And so like all of these people, I mean, it seems like an oxymoron to even say it, right?
Right.
But so like all of his crew is like, what is with this dude? And it's like, y'all, do you know what he's lived through? Like his whole
mindset.
He doesn't care.
Yeah. This is not a big deal to him.
Exactly. Like his whole mindset when his team tried to hold him back was like, I mean, like, I don't know what your problem. I have a gun. Like, I'm fine. Like if the tiger just gets a hold of my arm, then I'll just shoot him before he finishes
the
job.
What's the worst thing? I lose an arm.
Exactly.
No big deal.
It was very much like that. He brought kind of that boldness and kind of that experience of having had these near, like have looking death in the face so many times into the way in which he captured video. And so, you know, something else about him as well is he was all about kind of finding that story and kind of the human element. And so connecting with the people that they would follow. Now it's interesting because like as I kind of looked at this guy's life and started like detailing out like who he was, you know, originally I was like, okay, I'm very interested in this guy because ultimately he's going to become the producer and the creator of King Kong.
Yeah.
But in all of this, you can actually see kind of the inspiration. Have you seen the movie King Kong?
It's been a long time, but I have seen it. Yeah.
So in King Kong, there's actually the primary character is heavily based off of him. And I mean, like he writes himself into this movie in so many respects because he's out here, he's going on these expeditions. He's just kind of looking for nature and for story and that sort of thing. And so, you know, he's got this, you know, devil may care attitude when it comes to danger as, you know, trying to capture this. This is freaking Cooper. Like this is himself writing himself into the story of King Kong. And the thing is he had this idea for this kind of guerrilla film that he wanted to make. And, you know, nowadays you think about monster movies, you know, you've got even like Godzilla versus King Kong and kind of like all of these kaiju films and everything else. Back then, I want to make a movie about a giant gorilla. This is before CGI.
Yeah.
This is before, you know, like stop motion was around. In fact, stop motion was pretty, you know, being used. That was the special effect of the day. But even still, it's still a little like...
It's stop motion.
It's stop motion.
Right.
Like, it's like a puppet. And in his mind, he has this like, you know, this monster movie, this kind of primal like force that he wants to bring to New York City and like have this terrifying experience.
It's almost an idea that there's not even a, it's almost like he had to invent the technology to make it happen.
That's,
like,
you know, and most of our great filmmakers, that's exactly have done that. Where they are.
Yeah.
Exactly. The technology doesn't exist to capture their imagination. So they have to push the technology
right.
to get there. Man, that was Cooper. He was always about pushing that technology. And, you know, so when he finally was able to find somebody to produce this film, it started going over budget really, really quickly because they've got, you know, they've got this animatronics, they have these massive sets and everything. In order to try to save money, they actually shot a different film using the exact same, like sets, a lot of the same crew, like the exact same crew, most of the same cast, and they produced The Most Dangerous Game. Now, I don't think that's based off the book, The Most Dangerous Game, but it might be. I've actually never seen it. It came out in 1932. And like, if you look at that movie, it's like, oh no, this is all happened. Like it could be the same universe, right? Like,
right.
It's the exact same thing. No giant monkey. Like, you know what I mean? There's no giant like gorilla or anything, but I mean like it's the exact same cast and everything else. And they're just kind of doing it in their spare time because they have to like make up for the fact that like this budget is insane.
Yeah.
And so thus with that one budget, they created two movies. It wasn't a bad idea, all things considered.
Yeah,
it worked out pretty well. All right, so he's pushing forth this movie, and when he first originally kind of pitches the idea and finally gets a company that's going to, you know, work with him on it, his idea, again, stop motion, kind of kitschy, and people aren't really dealing with it. CGI, nobody's thought of it, right? Like, it's not like, what's a computer? So he's trying to figure out, like, how to do this. What do you think, Merriam C. Cooper, what do you think he does? How do you think he's going to capture, like, the realness of like this giant gorilla? What do you think he's going to do? Just what do you think?
I mean, in my mind, it's like you got to dress someone up in a costume.
No. That's too cheesy, man. What do you think? Merriam C. Cooper, the guy that gets like live tigers to attack him. Like, what do you think he's about to
do? Oh, he gets a real gorilla.
He gets a real gorilla. So he proposes this mindset of getting like the biggest like giant gorilla and shipping it in so they can use this gorilla to shoot these scenes with. And everybody is like, that's where we draw the line.
Not gonna happen.
It's like the worst idea ever.
To train this wild animal.
And you gotta understand, like, Cooper, like, you know, it's hard to just really communicate what his documentaries, as few of them as they were at the time, really did to audiences who don't have like the whiz bangness of our modern like media cinema going audiences.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Like, he did this thing. And there's a name for it. I'm kind of blanking on the name for it. But he shot Magnascope. He did this thing called Magnascope. And that's the idea where the image starts small on the screen and gets slowly larger. But it gets slowly larger as the action starts increasing.
Okay.
And he shot this elephant stampede through this village with literally the elephant stampede coming towards the camera. And as the shot, like, and he does this Magnascope thing so that it gets bigger over time.
As it's happening, yeah.
You and me, we look at that and we're like, huh, you know, okay.
But that was revolutionary.
It was revolutionary.
Right.
And like audiences.
In cinematography.
It blew their minds.
Right.
Because it brought not just the action, you know, it kind of brought in it in larger.
It escalated it.
It escalated it.
Right.
It escalated the fear and everything else. And so he was all about like pushing the envelope to communicate that intensity.
Hmm.
And I think that comes through with King Kong in particular. You know, I want to make reference of this. You know, you look at King Kong in the more modern retellings of the story. You haven't seen that at all, I'm sure. Like,
no,
none of like the modern monster movies or anything like that.
None
right?
of that. Mm-mm.
They do kind of a different modern take on King Kong where they have Sam Jackson play kind of the primary character. And he is going out, and it's the same type of deal. Like he's finishing up. I think it's World War One, or maybe it's World War Two. Maybe it's Vietnam. It's Vietnam War. He's fighting in the Vietnam War. he is, you know, the war ends and he's got that sense of like lack of completion, and he needs a victory. And so finding Kong and trying to destroy Kong becomes his like desire, like that conclusion.
Goal. Yeah.
And I feel like having now researched Miriam C. Cooper, I can't help but think that they looked at his early life and kind of inspired the Sam Jackson character. While Cooper's primary character in the original King Kong movie was very much based off the idealized version of who he saw himself as,
yeah,
and who he was as a documentarian, Sam Jackson's version was very much like who he was like during his wartime. You can kind of see that.
Wow.
And yeah, how they modeled that character. I had no idea when I saw that movie until I put it in the context.
That's really neat.
Of reading this. Man, he would go on to pioneer so many different techniques in the film industry. He was a big fan of when color came in. They had Technicolor, which is where they would go back and they would repaint the frames of these films and bring them into full color. And, you know, back then the picture business was like, nah, see, this color thing is never going to take, see? what are you going to do? You're going to have a bunch of people in a room. They're going to be painting every single cell. People, you know, this is ridiculous. It's too expensive. Never tell Miriam C. Cooper it's too expensive, because that is exactly where he's going to run to.
That's great.
This will kill you and it's too expensive. Sign me up. That's exactly where he's going to be. So he was a big advocate for Technicolor and kind of moving movies into more of like a bright, full colored spectrum. He was also a big fan of moving towards larger screen. So back in the day, you remember how, man, in our lifetime, televisions went from squares to rectangles?
Yeah, sure.
Isn't that crazy? Like, yeah, that's that, like,
just in the past, what, 25 years or something?
Exactly. Yeah. They went from squares to slightly smaller, like to small rectangles, to now where they're like these massive rectangles.
Just straight up rectangle.
The widescreen. Yeah. You could get the DVDs, which, kids, a DVD was a movie that instead of streaming it,
it was on this chip thing, yeah, that you bought, and you had to insert into this slot.
Exactly.
Right.
They had the,
after you blew it off and covered it with toothpaste,
they had the full screen and the widescreen. You remember that?
Yeah. Oh,
and you,
yeah,
had to choose based off of what TV is.
Mm-hmm.
So in the movie theaters, they, you know, when everything kind of got larger and you had the full cinematic scope of like the widescreen, he was present as that transition was going on. In fact, he was shooting a film at the time that he first experienced kind of the widescreen and was like, we got to redo this whole thing. We got to rethink everything, because widescreen is the way to go. And that's the way of the future. People didn't want to do it. It was a crazy technology. It required these custom cameras where it was like capturing essentially like three different shots at the, yeah, exact same time,
yeah,
just to make up, you know, the entire screen. And, you know, this is an aviation nut. This guy is going out and he's like, we're going to showcase this in an amazing way. He goes out and basically flies a plane across America with this camera attached to it so that he could really like champion this new technology of like a full screen, like cinematic experience.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, at the time, it was the only cinematic camera of its kind in the country. And it was flying around on an airplane all across the country. And had anything happened to that plane, it would have set back the industry.
Wow. Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So he was a big proponent of like advancing this technology to some extent, like, you know, no matter the cost. And I think it's because he did experience so much of you know, that near-death experience in his early life, that he was driven to go further, go faster. World War II happens. Once again, he is not a fan of war profiteering. He himself, you know, I talked a lot about his movie experience. He also had a lot of aviation experience as well. He was on the board of directors for one of the first, you know, consumer flight companies in the country.
Yeah.
He sold all of his stock in aviation once World War II started because he did not want to profit again from war.
It's just part of his fabric.
But at the same time, he went back into service. In fact, he was actually present when the Japanese signed the letter of surrender.
Oh, wow.
Because of his service during World War II.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, he, after World War II, you know, he was, again, he's in this place where he's got this aviation background. He's got this Hollywood background. He absolutely loves America. He hates communism. And he feels like the best way to fight communism is for Americans to really kind of see themselves in their own story. And so he gets heavy into like cowboy Western films.
Yeah.
And this gets back to like the thing that I was saying at the very beginning. When you think about like America, and when you think about the iconography of America, you have like these different ideas. You have like, you know, New York with the Empire State Building and like, you know, these kind of, you know, these icons of how the world perceives America. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sure. Then you also have like, you know, the Western and kind of the Wild West. And that was also part of kind of the iconography of America. And over the years it's changed, right? We're a melting pot. We've got all these different kind of imageries that kind of, you know, people associate for good or for ill with America. Mm-hmm. But like in his mind, like he really wanted to push those icons, not just so that the world could see America in this way, but so Americans could see themselves in this way.
Hmm.
And so like he really kind of championed a lot of like cowboy films and like got really super deep into that, especially kind of late in life.
That's neat.
He was an eccentric man, constantly known for smoking a pipe. He was never very put together. He would fit very well on Country Squire Radio in that way. He was never very put together. He always looked a little slapdash, but always talking himself up like crazy. Like these Hollywood types, like, oh, I'm the greatest of the greatest. You know, that kind of deal.
Oh, I know that guy. I know that guy.
And I can't give him like the guy, the classic, you know, whatever kind of thing. Because there's audio that you can find of his voice. And he is just very Southern, you know, like he
was
born
funny.
In Jacksonville, Florida. And even though it traveled all around the world, you can hear exactly where he came from. You know,
wow.
Like,
yeah, you
can hear that in his voice.
He fell off the turnip truck.
Right,
<yeah.
laughs> exactly. And it's wild because you do see him popping up literally all over the world. His education in the country before he even leaves the country is all over the country. He goes all over the world. But I tell you what, when you hear him, you wouldn't assume that he's ever been a day outside of Florida. You know? Again, always smoking a pipe, an eccentric individual, and somebody certainly worth half a bowl of history.
Oh my gosh, beyond.
Can
yeah.
I tell you, I barely scratched the surface of my own notes, and my own notes barely scratched the surface of his history.
Of him, yeah.
It's crazy.
Oh, it's wonderful, though. What an interesting character. Someone that obviously had a lot of conviction, but was incredibly talented and thoughtful about what the future was supposed to look like in his mind, and made a lot of it happen. So, that's so great.
Well done, man. It's an interesting era to mine for pipe smokers who are doing some really crazy things.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, like, and so I encourage folks to you know, look into it and yeah, you know, classic Hollywood.
Yeah, more than anything, it just makes me want to go watch King Kong again.
I tell you what, and I mean, like, it made me, yes, it did, and especially like hearing people talk about how that movie like impacted them and how it terrified them, and it was just like,
yeah,
this,
sure.
I mean, we look at it, it's like it's a stop motion gorilla, and right. It looks silly to us. But to them, it just blew their minds.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. And what I love about the way in which the modern kaiju films like in America have done, like with, you know, the, I think they call it the Monsterverse, where you have all like, you know, Mothra and Godzilla and King Kong. They all exist in like the same universe now and everything. The way in which they reintroduce King Kong in the modern context, I never knew that they were really, that they were pulling from like Cooper's life. In the same way that like Cooper was pulling from his own, but they were pulling from his life like further back. And I think it tells a more human story in the modern context because they were tapping into not the idealized version of yourself you always wanted to be as a kid, but who you actually are.
Hmm.
It works really well.
Hmm.
So, and as much
especially someone as strong and as just had so many interesting life experiences.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah.
In as much as it does, like this might encourage you to go back and watch the original Kong, which absolutely go for it. That's an important piece of American cinema. Check out the new one. I slept on that one for a long time. And I watched it when like the Godzilla versus Kong movie came out. I was like, well, I do kind of want to see, you know, King Kong and Godzilla fight.
Yeah. Too. Yeah.
And so I went back and rewatched it. And I remember I was like, no, this is actually a pretty good movie, but now it makes me really want to see it again through this lens.
Right.
So anyway,
that's great, man. Well done. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Look,
I enjoyed it.
Love a half bowl of history. Hey, if you want to have a half bowl of pipe tobacco, what should you be smoking?
You should be smoking a Missouri Meerschaum.
I can score got my room for some
They have a fun series called Back to Our Roots.
That's
and
right.
It's a beautiful series that has a real nice blonde finish on the bowl of the pipes, three corncob pipes, one hardwood pipe, and then a very lovely green stem. And it comes in four different shapes, the Bracken, the Maddox, the Boone, and the Zenon. And all of them are available right now on corncobpipe.com. And so if you'll go there, they will be glad to send one right to your front door.
There you go. And big thanks to our friends at Missouri Meerschaum for sponsoring this show.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Quick fire question. All right, man. Quick fire questions from Jeremy. All right, so we're continuing Jeremy's quest to find like the perfect pipe, right? Like, this is where he set us out on here.
Okay.
All right. Short, so like a bulldog, or medium or long? So, and he gives examples here. So short, like a bulldog, medium, like a Bings or like a Von Erich, or long, like a church warden.
Yeah, probably a medium sized pipe, I would think. Yeah. I mean, there's medium sized bulldogs and whatnot too, but yeah, I think that would kind of fit my profile
your
there.
MO right there.
Yeah.
I tend to be medium, but at the same time, now that I think about it, like a lot of my pipes are kind of short.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like a short pipe. But yeah, probably more on the medium side, I'd say.
Yeah.
Thick shank or pencil shank?
Between the two, pencil shank, I really prefer just kind of a medium normal size shank. I used to like those very slender shank pipes, but yeah, more of a medium now. But if I had to pick between the two, pencil shank.
Let's go pencil. I'm right there with you. Shank garnish or plain? So like a brass, silver, gold, bamboo, or just straight plain?
I really like either sterling silver or gold, if it's real gold. I love those, but yeah, those are really nice. And then he says, John David, correct me if I'm wrong, but the band around the shank is called a ferrule. And yeah, that's correct. It's this little, kind of metal cap that goes over the end of the shank there. So, really pretty, but I like the silver and the gold.
Yeah. I didn't know that gold was used. Wouldn't that be too malleable with the heated surface like that?
No. We sold a Dunhill estate pipe not too long ago that had 14 karat gold on it. Matter of fact, in the shop right now, I've got a Caminetto gorgeous pipe that may one day come home with me if no one buys it. It's got 18 karat gold and 18 karat gold ferrule on it. Yeah, stunning pipe. Yeah.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. I too like silver. I like a silver shank for sure. Like, or silver on the shank, I should say. All right, then finally, nomenclature proudly displayed or cleverly hidden?
I think proudly displayed. If I'm smoking a really nice pipe, like I'd like to see the name there.
So this is where I think we actually go in different directions. Like I, if it's a symbol,
yeah,
you know what I mean, like a dot or like a little Viking helmet or like a carving, like
whatever it is,
whatever it is. Like if it's a symbol, especially if it's like a sleek symbol, mm-hmm. then it can be proudly displayed.
Something cool, yeah.
But if it's like the name stamped on it,
yeah,
no,
yeah, you can hide that.
No, hide that. Like. Maybe don't even put it on there. Let the work speak for itself.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's my two cents. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there you go. Well, that's quickfire questions from Jeremy. Thanks, Jeremy, for that. And hey, if you got quickfire questions for us, be sure to send them into the show. That is show@countrysquireradio.com.
Your thoughts, your comments, listener feedback.
Listener feedback. This one's coming in from Desharidar. Desharidar, 87. He says, hey, I'm a fan of the podcast. I listen to it weekly with John David and Bo's Legends of the Pipe series, or whatever name they change it to. I have a candidate that they may be interested in. Shelby Foote is a renowned author and I think is from Mississippi. He wrote The Popular Civil War, a narrative that was on Ken Burns' Civil War documentary from the 90s. He was always smoking a pipe.
Yeah, so we have talked about Shelby Foote quite a bit on the show. Yep. It's actually been a long time since we have. But yeah, a Memphis native, Shelby Foote, obviously very famous pipe smoker and Southern scholar, Civil War scholar, someone that, you know, is very in some ways really, he was kind of like the, you know, these scientists that like popularize science like Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson, like in some ways, like he was that for American history. Like he popularized it in some way for the U.S.
Kind of made it tangible.
Made it accessible and told the story in a way that folks could grasp it, the realness of it. So, yeah, Mr. Foote was from Memphis, and I think he may have grown up in Holly Springs, which is North Mississippi, if I'm remembering that right. But, yeah, famous pipe smoker.
I bet it, man. Really, really nice. Thanks for that recommendation. We also got one from James who said, I would like to suggest Charles Nelson Reilly for a pipe smoker episode. He was an actor and comedian, on Match Game for many years, and was often smoking his pipe during the show.
Yeah, Charles Nelson Reilly, yeah.
We also heard from David Lamontagne, said, I'm really enjoying your podcast on pirates. Maybe think about doing one, legendary Marine general pipe smoker, Lewis Chesty Puller.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, very, very cool.
It'd be great.
You know, so these are all great recommendations. We really appreciate getting those in. I do, you know, I've been very much thinking about, you know, kind of who next and that sort of thing. I was sharing with you, I've got kind of a short list of people I definitely want to hit up in the near future.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also one individual, though, as well from Hollywood that I do want to do another, like, special on. And that is, Ricky Ricardo. Who played Ricky Ricardo from?
Desi Arnaz. Yeah, yeah.
That dude was a BA dude.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I think as I was reading about, like, you know, kind of the fervent anti-communist, I was thinking about the whole, like, the Red Scare and then how Lucy was tied up with that, but how was also like a hardcore anti-communist as like, well, and then like, you know, like, so you had this like hardcore anti-communist and then like, you know, his wife was on trial because like the world was coming after because she had signed up with the Communist Party when she was a kid. And
I guess I'd forgotten all that.
It's a fascinating story. And then just Desi is just a fascinating individual who was like a pioneer, you know, as like a Cuban American at the time.
Yeah,
too, like,
sure.
And a pipe smoker. And so like definitely somebody that we'll be covering in the future.
That's cool.
So I'll leave that as a teaser and look forward to covering it down the line.
You know, little Ricky lives in Jackson, right?
I did not know. Is that true?
That is fact.
Shut the front door.
I can tell you more about it later, but little Ricky lives in Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, we're saving. What? What?
He does.
Come on.
He does.
This is a series that keeps on giving. Y'all, thanks so much for tuning in. You can keep up with us. Find all our contact information, Country Squire Radio. That's going to do it for us for this week. Hey, man, let's go have a day.
See you, brother.
how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.